Brian Stevenson grew up in a poor black neighborhood in Delaware, and he wound up at Harvard Law School. When he graduated, he headed south to Alabama because he wanted to use his law degree to help the victims of the criminal justice system. Prisoners on death row. Children incarcerated in adult prisons. People unfairly tried and wrongfully convicted. Most of them poor and black. For decades, Brian Stevenson's been fighting judges and prosecutors and police on behalf of the disenfranchised. Archbishop Desmond Tutu calls him America's young Nelson Mandela. Now he's written a stunning memoir called Just Mercy, a story of justice and redemption. Steve Paulson talked with him.
Brian, one of the most remarkable cases that you've written about involves a man named Walter McMillan, who was on death row for a crime he didn't commit. What was he accused of doing?
He was accused of committing a murder that took place in downtown Monroeville, Alabama. And it was a young woman who was white, who was from an affluent family. And the crime really unsettled the community because it took place right in downtown Monroeville, and the police couldn't make an arrest. There was a lot of disruption, a lot of anxiety, a lot of fear and anger. And 6 months after the crime had taken place, when they had no leads, you could hear people whispering about the competence of the sheriff and the district attorney. And so there was enormous pressure on law enforcement to make an arrest.
And so why was Walter arrested?
Well, this is where it gets very interesting. Walter McMillan was a 45-year-old African-American with no prior crime history. He was not somebody you would suspect of committing a murder. All we could identify that brought Walter to the attention of these folks was that he was having an affair with a young white woman. And we believe that's what provoked some people to target him. And he was eventually arrested and charged with this murder, even though at the time of the crime, he was raising money for his sister's church about 11 miles from the crime scene, surrounded by 30 other African Americans who could all vouch for his presence at this house 11 miles away. The sheriff was so determined to make an arrest that they just ignored all of that and then really tried to demonize him. They put him on death row before the case ever went to trial. It's the only case I've ever worked on where the client was actually placed on death row for 15 months before trial. And of course, that meant that the press would say death row defendant Walter McMillan will be arraigned, or death row defendant Walter McMillan has filed these kinds of pretrial pleadings. And it really painted him in this dangerous way. It was a really, really outrageous case. And of course, the ultimate irony is that Monroeville, Alabama, is where the famed novelist Harper Lee grew up.
Right, and where she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, which is all about correcting racial injustice.
Exactly.
How were you able to get Walter's conviction overturned?
We eventually were able to show that the state had withheld exculpatory evidence that they obviously should have disclosed. The witnesses all recanted. And when we got all of the witnesses to recant, the Alabama Bureau of Investigation did another investigation and agreed with us that Mr. McMillan was innocent and all the charges were dismissed, but not without real cost to Mr. McMillan. He spent 6 years on death row, you know, was there when 8 people were executed, and it haunted him for the rest of his life. He talked about being able to smell the flesh burning when people were electrocuted in the electric chair, and it was obviously devastating to have an entire state trying to kill you day after day, week after week, month after month.
This has to be quite unusual, this kind of case. But are there a lot of wrongful convictions?
It's shocking how frequently this takes place. For every 9 people who have been executed in America, we've now identified 1 innocent person on death row who's been exonerated. There have been over 150 exonerations of innocent people on death row. It's a shocking rate of error. I don't think any of us would tolerate this kind of error in any other area of public life. I know that in the aviation industry, if for every 9 planes that took off, 1 crashed and everyone died, nobody would fly. It just would be unacceptable. Yet we have tolerated the kind of error that we've seen in too many jurisdictions.
You have also represented kids, I mean, children as young as 13, who were, in some cases, sentenced to life in prison without parole. And you tell a story about one boy, I think he was 14 at the time, named Charlie. What was he in jail for?
Yeah, that was one of my early cases, a really tragic case of a child who was living in a house where his mother was repeatedly the target of a lot of domestic violence. This boy's mother had a boyfriend that would start drinking and just become violent. And one day the man had been drinking, came home, came into the kitchen, walked up to the boy's mother, punched her in the face, knocked her unconscious. And this little boy was trying to get his mom to wake up. And after 10 minutes of trying to revive his mom, she was covered with blood. And the little boy thought his mom was dead. And the man had gone into a bedroom and fallen asleep. So the little boy got up, walked into the bedroom, opened a dresser drawer, pulled out a handgun, and then walked over to where the man was sleeping. The man was snoring, and when the man stopped snoring, the little boy tragically pulled the trigger, shot the man in the head, and he died instantly. Child was about 5 feet tall. He was under 100 pounds. He was only 14. And he was the kind of kid who might have been tried as a child, but for the fact that the man that he shot and killed, his mother's boyfriend, he was a deputy sheriff. And because of his status, the prosecutor insisted that this child be prosecuted as an adult and was immediately placed in the adult jail. And that's where I'd met him for the first time after he'd been there for 3 days. And it was heartbreaking because I couldn't get this child to say a word. He just kept staring at the wall. And eventually I got up and I walked around the table and pulled my chair close to him and said, "Look, I can't help you if you don't talk to me. You got to talk to me." He wouldn't say a word. And there was a point at which I just started leaning on him because I couldn't figure out what else to do. And when I did that, this little boy leaned back. And when he leaned back, I put my arm around him and said, "Come on, talk to me." And this child began to cry. And through his tears, he began talking to me, not about what happened with the man, not about what happened with his mom. But he started talking about what had happened at the jail. And he told me on the first night he'd been hurt by several men. He told me on the next night he'd been raped by several people. He told me on the night before I'd gotten there, so many people had hurt him, he couldn't remember how many there had been. And I held this little boy while he cried hysterically, you know, for almost an hour. And when I left that jail, I couldn't help but think, who is responsible for this? And I realized we are. We've allowed our society to put children in these imperiled places behind a narrative that's false and incomplete, behind our anger and fear. All children are children, but our laws don't reflect that. We try to treat children as adults when they're not. And it set me on a path that has resulted in us challenging in a pretty aggressive way the prosecution of children as adults. We've been to the Supreme Court a couple of times and won some cases that have created some relief for kids prosecuted as adults, but there's still a lot more work to be done.
Is there anything you could do to help this boy, Charlie?
We got him out of that jail immediately, and I write in the book about a wonderful family that ultimately got involved with him, and I'm happy to report he's doing really well. We were able to get him out after a relatively short period of time, and he's doing really well. But obviously, that's a lifelong burden to have to bear. And even as we speak, there are some 10,000 children in the United States in adult jails or prisons. There are about 28 states that still allow kids 17 and younger to be placed in adult jails or prisons where they have no sight or sound separation from adults. And they're about 8 times more likely to be the victims of sexual assault and about 11 times more likely to attempt suicide.
There's so many issues at play here. One is, the obvious injustice in the criminal courts. As you've described, some of these cases, for instance, of wrongful conviction or just sort of horrible treatment of people. There's also just the kind of conversation that it seems like we need to have about race and justice in this country. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on what we can do about that, how we can talk about this.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I do think we've practiced silence about these issues for too long. Many countries that have tried to recover from gross violations of human rights have recognized that there has to be truth and reconciliation. You can't ignore what's happened. We haven't done that. We never in this country talked about slavery and the distortions created by the narrative of racial difference that slavery represented. For me, the great evil of slavery was not involuntary servitude. It was this ideology of white supremacy that we created to legitimate slavery.
It seems like we have talked about slavery, though. It's in all of our history books, but you're saying we haven't had, the real conversation we need to have about it?
Yes, and I don't think actually what's in our history books represents the true evil of slavery. I mean, if you live in my part of the country, I'm sitting here in Montgomery, Alabama, where 2 years ago there were 59 monuments and markers to the mid-19th century. We celebrate the Confederacy in this region of the country. In this state, Jefferson Davis's birthday is a state holiday. A Confederate Memorial Day is a state holiday. It's not Martin Luther King Day. It's Martin Luther King / Robert E. Lee Day. And we've romanticized the mid-19th century, and we've glorified it, and we haven't said a word about slavery. If you came here 2 years ago, you wouldn't find a word about it. And so I don't think we've actually confronted the legacy of that narrative. In my view, slavery didn't end in 1865. It evolved. And that's not something we've talked about, because we were compromised by this difference, this narrative, this ideology, this racial hierarchy for decades. And that's why we then had lynching, and that's why we had convict leasing. That's how we got to segregation and the need for a civil rights movement. And we still haven't talked about the narrative of racial difference. We've never had truth and reconciliation. And because of that, I think we are still compromised by our failure to deal honestly with this issue. If you go to Germany, you are forced to deal with the legacy of the Holocaust. There are monuments and markers everywhere.
What would you want us to do? I mean, how should we be dealing with this history?
Well, we're starting in Montgomery. So I mentioned how there were all of these monuments and markers to the Confederacy and nothing about slavery. We erected three markers to the slave trade, and we put them in public spaces with great resistance. The Alabama Historical Association didn't want us to do it. They said it would be too controversial. But I think that's a healthy step forward. I want to mark the spaces where lynchings took place. I want to mark the spaces where people suffered from segregation. I think we ought to create enough truth about our history that we begin to think and talk about what reconciliation requires. And this isn't just an issue for people of color. You know, we've got a generation of people in this country who were taught that they're better than other people because of their skin color. And that's a kind of abuse in my judgment. And if we're not doing things to correct that, we're going to see the implicit bias that plays out day in and day out.
Brian Stevenson founded the Equal Justice Initiative in Alabama. He's a MacArthur Genius Award winner and author of Just Mercy, a story of justice and redemption. He talked with Steve Paulson.